above and behind them. For a moment, it alarmed them, echoing and hollow about the trees. Then one recovered himself and ran back towards the elm.
"Come down!" he shouted. "Come down out of there at once, or I'll shoot the life out of you!"
Chapter 4. Ross did not hear of the arrest until 10 o'clock, when one of the Martin children brought the news to him at the mine. He at once went home, saddled Darkie, and rode over to Wherry House. The Bodruggans were one of the decaying families of Cornwall. The main stem, having scored a none too scrupulous trail across local history for nearly 200 years, had given out in the middle of the century. The Wherry Bodruggans were following suit. Sir Hugh, the present baronet, was 50 and a bachelor, undersized, vigorous and stout. He claimed to have more hair on his body than any man living, a boast he was ready to put to the proof for a 50-guinea bet any evening with the port. He lived with his stepmother, the Dowager Lady Bodruggan, a hard-riding, hard-swearing woman of 29, who kept dogs all over the house and smelt of them. Ross knew them both by sight, but he could have wished that Jim had found other preserves to poach on. He wished it still more when he came to the house and saw that the Carnbarrow hunt was meeting there. Conscious of the stares and whispers of the people in their red coats and shining boots, he got down and threaded his way among horses and yapping dogs and went up the steps of the house. At the top, a servant barred his way.
"What do you want?"
he demanded, looking at Ross's rough working clothes. Ross stared back at him.
"Sir Hugh Bodruggan, and none of your damned impudence!"
The manservant made the best of it.
"Beg pardon, sir. Sir Hugh's in the library. What name shall I say?"
Ross was shown into a room full of people drinking port and canary sack. Conditions could hardly be more difficult for what he had to ask. He knew many of the people. Young Whitworth was here, and George Warleggan and Dr. Choke, and Patience Teague and Joan Pascoe, and Ruth Teague with John Treneglas, eldest son of Mr. Horace Treneglas. He looked over the heads of most of them, and saw Sir Hugh's squat form by the fireplace, legs astraddle, and glass raised. He saw the manservant approach and whisper in Sir Hugh's ear, and heard Bodruggan's impatient,
"Who? What? What?"
This much he was able to hear, because there had been a temporary dropping off in conversation. Some day he might come to accept this as a natural event when he entered a room. He nodded and half-smiled to some of the guests as he walked through them towards Sir Hugh. There was a sudden outburst of barks, and he saw that Constance Lady Bodruggan was on her knees on the hearthrug, tying up a dog's paw, while 6 black spaniels licked and lurched about her.
"Blast me! I thought it was Francis," said Sir Hugh. "Your servant, sir. The hunt starts in 10 minutes.
"5 is all I need," Ross said pleasantly. "But those I should like in private."
"There's nowhere private in the house this morning, unless it's the Jericho. Speak up, for there's too much noise for anyone to eavesdrop on your private affairs."
"The man who left this bloody glass about," said his stepmother.
"I'd horsewhip him, by God!"
Ross took the wine offered him and explained his mission to the baronet. A poacher had been taken on Bodruggan land last night, a boy known personally to himself. Sir Hugh, being a magistrate, would no doubt have something to do with the hearing of the case. It was the boy's first offence, and there was strong reason to believe that he had been led away by an older and more hardened rogue. Ross would consider himself under an obligation to make good any loss if the boy could be dismissed with a severe warning. Moreover, he would be personally responsible. At this stage, Sir Hugh burst into a roar of laughter. Ross stopped.
"Blast me, but you come too late, sir. Too late by half. I had him up before me at 8 o'clock this morning. He's on his way to Truro now. I've committed him for trial at the next quarter sessions."
Ross sipped his wine. "You were in haste, Sir Hugh."
"Well, I didn't want to be delayed dealing with the fellow when it was the day of the meet. I knew by 9 o'clock the house would be in a pandemonium."
"The poacher," said Lady Bodruggan, struck with the idea as she released the dog. "I suspicion it was he who dropped the glass. I'd have him flogged at the cartwheel, by God. The laws are too easy on the varmints."
"Well, he'll not be troubling my pheasants for a week or two," said Sir Hugh, laughing heartily.
"Not for a week or two. You must agree, Captain Poldark, it's a standing disgrace, the amount of good game that's lost in a year."
"I'm sorry to have intruded on your hunting time."
"Sorry your mission ain't a happier one. I've a nag to lend you if you've a mind to join the hunt."
Ross thanked him, but refused. After a moment, he made his excuses and left. There was no more he could do here. As he moved away from them, he heard Lady Bodruggan say,
"You don't mean you'd have let me varmint go free, Hughie?"
He couldn't hear her stepson's reply, but there was a ripple of laughter among those who did. The attitude of the Bodruggans to his idea of letting a poacher off with a warning was, he knew, the attitude all society would adopt, though they might dress it in politer phrases. Even Cornish society, which looked with such tolerance on the smuggler. The smuggler was a clever fellow, who knew how to cheat the government of its revenues and bring them brandy at half price. The poacher not only trespassed literally upon someone's land, he trespassed metaphorically upon all the inalienable rights of personal property. He was an outlaw and a felon. Hanging was barely good enough. Ross came up against the same attitude a few days later when he spoke to Dr. Choke. Jim was not likely to be brought up for trial before the last week in May. He knew that Choke, in his capacity of mine surgeon, had treated Jim as recently as February, and he asked him his opinion of the boy. Choke said, "Well, what could you expect with phthisis in the family?" By auscultation, he had detected a certain morbid condition in one lung. But how far it had developed, it was not possible to say. Of course, the complaint had various forms. Mortification of the lung might set in early or late. He might even live to be 40, which was a fair age for a minor. One couldn't tell. Ross suggested that the information would be of use at the quarter sessions. Evidence of serious ill health, together with a plea from himself, might possibly get the charge dismissed. If Choke would give evidence at the trial. Choke knit his brows in a perplexed stare. Did he mean? Ross did mean. Choke shook his head incredulously.
"My dear sir, we do much for a friend, but don't ask us to testify on behalf of a young vagrant who's been caught poaching. We couldn't do it. 'Twould come unnatural to us. Like mothering a Frenchie."
Ross pressed, but Choke would not budge.
"To tell the truth, I haven't a deal of sympathy for your aims," he said at length. "No good will come of being sentimental about such folk. But I'll set you out a note of what I've said about the boy, signed with my own hand and sealed like a writ. That will be just as good as going there and standing in the box like a felon. We couldn't do that."
Ross grudgingly accepted. The following day, Wheel Leisure had its first official visit from Mr. Treneglis. He stumped over from Mingus with a volume of Livy under his arm and a dusty three-cornered hat stuck on top of his wig. There was mining blood in the Treneglis family. He saw what there was to be seen. Three shafts were being sunk. But it was hard going. They had struck ironstone almost at once. This, in places, meant working with steel borers and then blowing with gunpowder. The layer ran east to west and seemed to be of some size, so the next few weeks were likely to be tedious for all. Mr. Treneglis said, "Well, that would mean more expense," but the circumstance was not discouraging. Rich loads of copper were often found in ironstone.
"Nature's safe," he said. "She keeps her treasures under lock and key."
They went to the edge of the cliff and stared over the edge to the flimsy wooden platform halfway down, from which 8 men in 12-hour cores of 4 had begun driving an adit into the cliff. They had long since gone from view. All that could be seen from the cliff top was a boy of 12 who appeared from time to time with a barrow whose contents, the refuse of the 4 tunnelling beetles, he emptied onto the sand below. They too, Ross said, had met ironstone and were trying to find a way round it. Mr. Treneglis grunted and said he hoped those 2 old women, Choke and Pierce, wouldn't start whinnying about the expense at the next meeting. How long had they reckoned on it taking them to bring home that adit to the mine, eh?
3 months, Ross said.
It will take all of 6, said Mr. Treneglis to himself. It will take all of 6, he assured Ross. By the by, have you heard the news?
What news?
My son John and Ruth Teague. They've made it up together. They are going to be wed, you know.
Ross didn't know. Mrs. Teague would be in transports.
She's done well for herself,
the old man said, as if for once he spoke Ross's thoughts instead of his own.
She's done well for herself getting John, even though he is a small matter boisterous in his cups. I could have wished for some maid with money to her name, for we're none too easy set for our position. Still, she takes offence well, and she's suitable enough other ways. I heard of a fellow the other day who was carrying on with his kitchen wench. I can't remember who 'twas. Serious, I mean, not for a lark. It all depends how you treat a thing like that. I well remember John put one of our serving girls in the straw before ever he was 17.
I hope they'll be happy.
Eh? Oh, yes. Well, I shall be glad to see him settled. I shan't last forever, and there hasn't been a bachelor master of Mingus for 80 years.
You're a magistrate, Ross said. What is the sentence for poaching?
Eh? Eh?
Mr. Treneglis clutched at his old hat, just in time to save it from the wind.
For poaching? It all depends, dear boy. All depends. If a man is caught with a whippet and snare in his keeping, then, if 'tis a first conviction, he may be given 3 or 6 months. If he's been convicted before, or has been caught in the act, as the saying is, then no doubt he'll be sent for transportation. You have to be strong on the rogues, else we'd have no game at all. How's your uncle, boy?
I haven't seen him this month.
I doubt if he will go magistrating again. I suppose he takes it easy. Perhaps he pays too much heed to the physical profession. I mistrust 'em myself. Rhubarb's my cure. As for the doctors, Timeo denaus sed dona ferentis. That's my motto. That's my motto, he added to himself. Should be Charles's.
The trial took place on the 30th of May. It had been a cold and unsettled spring, with strong winds and days of chilly rain. But in the middle of the month, the weather began to clear, and the last week was quiet and suddenly very warm. Spring and midsummer were telescoped into 1 week. In 6 days of blazing sunshine, the entire countryside grew and set into its richest green. The delayed spring blossoms came out overnight, bloomed as in a hothouse, and were gone. The day of the trial was very warm, and Ross rode into Truro early with the songs of the birds all the way. The courtroom would have been gloomy and decrepit at the best of times. Today, the tunnels of sunlight streaming in through the dirty windows fell on the gnarled old benches and showed up the big cobwebs in the corners of the room and hanging from the rafters. It picked out the emaciated clerk of the court, bending over his papers with a pendulous drop glinting from his nose, and fell in patches on the ill-kempt spectators crowded together whispering and coughing at the back. There were 5 magistrates, and Ross was pleased to find that he had some acquaintance with 2 of them. One, the chairman, was Mr. Nicholas Warleggan, George's father. The other was the Reverend Dr. Edmund House, whom Ross had last met in the coach. A third he knew by sight, a fat, elderly man called Hick, one of the gentry of the town, who was drinking himself to death. During most of the morning, Dr. House kept his fine cambric handkerchief before his sharp, thin nose. No doubt it was well soaked with extract of bergamot and rosemary, a not unwise precaution with so much fever about. 2 or 3 cases were got through quickly enough in the heavy, airless atmosphere, and then James Carter was brought into the box. In the well of the court, Ginny Carter, who had walked the 9 miles with her father, tried to smile as her husband glanced towards her. During the period of his remand, his skin had lost its tan, and thick smudges below his dark eyes showed up. As the case began, the usher glanced up at the big clock on the wall, and Ross could see him deciding there would be just time for this case before the midday break. The magistrates were of the same opinion. Sir Hugh Bodruggan's gamekeeper had a tendency to wander in his evidence, and twice Mr. Warleggan sharply instructed him to keep to the point. This gave the witness stage fright, and he mumbled through to the end in a hurry. The other gamekeeper bore out the story, and that completed the evidence. Mr. Warleggan looked up.
"Is there any defence in this case?"
Jim Carter did not speak. The clerk got up, pushing away a dewdrop with his hand.
"There's no defence, Your Worship. There's been no previous conviction. I have a letter here from Sir Hugh Bodruggan complaining of how much game he's lost this year, and saying as how this is the first poacher they has been able to catch since January."
The magistrates put their heads together. Ross cursed Sir Hugh. Mr. Warleggan looked at Carter.
"Have you anything to say before sentence of this court is passed?"
Jim moistened his lips.
"No, sir."
"Very well, then."
Ross got up. "If I might ask the indulgence of the court." There was a stir and a mutter, and everyone turned to see who was disturbing the magisterial dust. Mr. Warleggan peered through the shafts of sunlight, and Ross nodded slightly by way of recognition.
"You have some evidence you wish to give in this man's defence?"
"I wish to give evidence of his good character," Ross said. "He has been my servant." Warleggan turned and held a whispered conference with Dr. Hulse. They had both recognised him now. Ross continued to stand up, while people shifted their positions and peered over each other's shoulders to get a view of him. Among those just to his left, he saw a face he recognised. One it was impossible to mistake. The moist, prominent mouth and slant eyes of Eli Clemo. He had perhaps come to gloat over Carter's downfall.
"Will you take the witness stand, sir?"
Warleggan said in his deep, careful voice.
"Then you may say what you have to say."
Ross left his seat and walked across the court to the witness box. He took the oath and made the pretense of kissing the greasy old Bible. Then he put his hands over the edge of the box and looked at the 5 magistrates. Hick was blowing as if asleep. Dr. House was dabbing lightly with his handkerchief, no trace of recognition in his eyes. Mr. Warleggan was looking through some papers. No doubt, gentlemen, on the evidence you have heard, you will see no reason to look for anything exceptional in this case. In your long experience, there must be many cases, especially at a time of distress such as this, when there are circumstances of hunger, of poverty, of sickness, which extenuate the offence in some degree. But naturally the laws must be administered, and I should be the last to ask of you that the ordinary poacher, who is a trouble and expense to all of us, should be allowed to go unpunished. I have, however, a close knowledge of the circumstances of this case, which I should like to put before you." Ross gave them a summary of Jim's vicissitudes, with particular stress on his ill health and the brutal assault made upon his wife and child by Reuben Clemo. "Living as he does in poverty, I have reason to believe that the prisoner fell into bad company and was persuaded away from certain promises he had made direct to me. I personally am sure of this boy's honesty. It is not he who should be in court, but the man who led him astray." He paused, and felt that he had the interest of his listeners. He was about to go on, when someone sniggered loudly in the well of the court. Several of the magistrates looked across, and Dr. Hulse frowned severely. Ross had no doubt who it was. "The man who led him astray," he repeated, trying to regain the wandering attention of his listeners. "I repeat that Carter has been led astray by a man much older than himself, who has so far escaped punishment. It's he who should bear the blame. As for the prisoner's present health, you have only to look at him to see what it is today. In confirmation of that, I have here a statement from Dr. Thomas Choke of Saul, the distinguished mind surgeon, that he has examined James Carter and finds him to be suffering from a chronic and putrid inflammation of the lung, which is likely to prove fatal. Now I am prepared to re-engage him in my employment and to stand surety for his good behaviour in the future. I ask for the consideration of these facts by the court, and that they should be taken into careful account before any sentence be passed." He handed to the clerk the piece of notepaper on which, in watery ink, Choke had scrawled his diagnosis. The clerk stood hesitantly, with it in his hand, until Mr. Warleggan impatiently beckoned him to pass it to the bench. The note was read, and there was a brief consultation.
"Is it your contention that the prisoner is not in a fit state of health to be sent to prison?"
Warleggan asked. "He is gravely ill."
"When was this examination made?"
Dr. Hulse asked coldly.
"About 3 months ago." "Then he was in this state when he went poaching."
Ross hesitated, aware now of the unfriendly nature of the question. "He has been ill for some time." Dr. Hulse sniffed at his handkerchief.
"Well, speaking for myself, I feel that if a man is, well enough to go stealing pheasants, he is, well enough to take the consequences."
"Aye, true enough,"
came a voice. Mr. Warleggan tapped on the desk.
"Any further disturbance?"
He turned.
"You know, Mr. Poldark, I am of a mind to agree with my friend, Dr. Hulse. It is no doubt a misfortune for the prisoner that he suffers these disabilities, but the law gives us no opportunity to draw fine distinctions. The degree of a man's need should not determine the degree of his honesty. Else all beggars would be thieves, and if a man is well enough to err, he is surely also well enough to be punished."
"Yet," Ross said, bearing in mind the fact that he has already suffered nearly 4 weeks' imprisonment, and bearing in mind his good character and his great poverty, I cannot help but feel that in this case justice would be best served by clemency." Warleggan thrust out his long upper lip.
"You may feel that, Mr. Poldark, but the decision rests with the bench. There has been a marked increase in lawlessness during the last 2 years. This, too, is a form of law-breaking, both difficult and expensive to detect. And those who are apprehended must be prepared to bear their full share of the blame. Nor can we apportion the guilt. We can only take cognizance of the facts."
He paused.
"In view, however, of the medical testimony, and of your own testimony as to Carter's former good character, we are willing to take a more lenient view of the offence than we should otherwise have done. The prisoner is sentenced to 2 years' imprisonment."
There was a murmur in the court, and someone muttered a word of disgust. Ross said, "I trust I may never have the misfortune to have the leniency of the court extended to me." Dr. Hulse lowered his handkerchief.
"Have a care, Mr. Poldark. Such remarks are not entirely outside our jurisdiction."
Ross said, "Only mercy enjoys that privilege." Mr. Warleggan waved a hand.
"Next case."
"One moment," said Dr. Hulse. He leaned forward, putting his fingertips together and pursing his thin lips. He disliked this arrogant young squireen afresh every time they met, at school, in the coach, in court. He was particularly gratified at having been able to put that sharp little question about dates, which had turned the other magistrates to his own way of thinking. But even so, the young upstart was trying to have the last word. It would not do.
"One moment, sir. We don't come here and administer justice according to the statute book without a considerable sense of our privileges and responsibilities. As a member of the church, sir, I feel that responsibility with especial weight. God has given to those of his ministers who are magistrates the task of tempering justice with clemency. That task I discharge to the best of my poor ability, and I think it has been so discharged now. Your insinuations to the contrary are offensive to me. I do not think you have the least idea what you are talking about." "These savage laws," Ross said, controlling his temper with the greatest difficulty. "These savage laws, which you interpret without charity, send a man to prison for feeding his children when they are hungry, for finding food where he can when it's denied him to earn it. The book from which you take your teaching, Dr. Hulse, says that man shall not live by bread alone. These days you're asking men to live without even bread." A murmur of approval at the back of the court grew in volume. Mr. Warleggan rapped angrily with his hammer.
"The case is closed, Mr. Poldark. You will kindly step down."
"Otherwise," said Dr. Hulse, "we will have you committed for contempt of court."
Ross bowed slightly. "I can only assure you, sir, that such a committal would be a reading of my inmost thoughts." He left the box and pushed his way out of court, amid much noise and the shouts of the usher for silence. In the narrow street outside, he took a breath of the warm summer air. The deep gutter here was choked with refuse, and the smell was unsavoury, but it seemed agreeable after the smell of the court. He took out a kerchief and mopped his forehead. His hand was not quite steady from the anger he was trying to control. He felt sick with disgust and disappointment. A long mule train was coming down the street, with the heavy panniers of tin slung on each side of the animals, and with a number of travel-stained miners plodding slowly along by their side. They had walked miles since dawn, from some outlying district with this tin for the coinage hall, and would ride home on the backs of the weary mules. He waited until they were all past, and then was about to cross the narrow street. A hand touched his arm. It was Ginny, with her father, Zaki Martin, in the rear. There were pink flushes in her cheeks, showing up against the pale, freckled skin.
"I want to thank ye, sir, for what you said. 'Twas more'n good of you to try so hard for Jim."
"And what you said?"
"It did no good," Ross said. Take her home, Zaki. She'll be best with you.
Yes, sir.
He left them abruptly and strode off up Coinage Hall Street. To be thanked for his failure was the last straw. His disgust was partly levelled at himself for having lost his temper. Be as independent as you liked when it was your own freedom you were bartering, but at least have a greater restraint when it was someone else's. His whole attitude, he told himself, had been wrong. A good beginning, and then it had gone awry. He was the last person to make a success of such a job. He should have been obsequious, flattering to the bench. He should have upheld and praised their authority, as he had begun by doing, and at the same time have brought it home to them that a lenient sentence might be passed out of the benevolence of their hearts. Deep down, he wondered if the golden voice of Sheridan would have charmed them from their prey. An even better approach, he thought now, would have been to see the magistrates before the court opened, and have pointed out to them how inconvenient it would be for him to be deprived of his manservant. That was the way to get a man off. Not by the testimony of doctors or sentimental appeals for clemency. He was in Princes Street by this time, and he turned down into the Fighting Cock's Inn. There he ordered a bottle of brandy, and set about drinking it. Chapter 5. In the hot sunshine of the early summer afternoon, Demelza and Prudy were thinning out the young turnips, which had been sown in the lower half of the long field. Prudy was not slow in her complaints, but if Demelza heard, she did not pay any attention. She thrust and dragged rhythmically with her hoe, breaking the young weeds at the same time as she cleared spaces for the growth of the plants. Now and then she paused, hands on hips, to stare out over Hendrawna Beach. The sea was very quiet under the hot sun. Faint airs moved across from time to time, brushing dark, gentle shadows over it, as over the down of a bird's wing. Where the water was shallow, its surface was an ever-shifting pattern of mauve and bottle-green wrinkles. Sometimes she hummed a tune, for she loved warmth of any kind, especially the warmth of the sun. Much to Prudy's disapproval, she had taken off her blue bonnet and worked now in one of her blue print frocks, with sleeves rolled up and bare legs and hard wooden-soled shoes. With a groan and a pressing of hands, as if this were a movement not often to be made, Prudy straightened her back and stood upright. With one dirty finger, she lifted her bonnet and tucked away a strand of black hair.
"I'll be that stiff in the morning. There's no more I can do today. My hips! I'll have no easement all the night."
She plucked at the heel of one slipper, which was tucked under, and was letting in a trickle of soil.
"You'd best finish too. There's calves to be meated, and I can't do all. Now you be this."
Demelza turned and frowned into the sun.
"Why, it's... what can he be wanting?"
She dropped her hoe and ran across the field towards the house.
"Father!"
she called. Tom Kahn saw her and stopped. She ran up to him. Since his last visit, when he had announced his coming marriage, her feelings for him had changed. The memory of his ill treatment was faded, and now that there was no point at issue between them, she was willing to let bygones be bygones, and to offer him affection. He stood there with his round hat on the back of his head, feet planted stolidly apart, and allowed Demelza to kiss the prickles of his black beard. She noticed at once that his eyes were less bloodshot, and that he was dressed in respectable clothes. A jacket of coarse grey cloth, a grey waistcoat, with thick trousers turned up some inches at the bottoms, showing brown worsted stockings and heavy shoes with bright brass clasps. She had forgotten that the widow Chegwidden had a long purse.
"Well, daughter," he said, "so you be still here?"
She nodded.
"And happy too. Hope you're the same."
He pursed his lips,
"'That's as may be. Is there any place we can talk, maid?'
"'There's no one can hear us here,' she answered. "'Set the crows, and they're not interested.'
At this he frowned and stared across at the house, lying close and warm in the sun.
"'I don't know 'tis any place for a daughter of mine,' he said harshly. "'I don't know 'tall. I've been much troubled about thee.'
She laughed.
"'What's to do wi' a daughter o' yourn?'
She was lapsing into the broader speech she had begun to lose.
"'And how's Luke, and Samuel, and William, and John, and Bobby, and Drake?'
"'Brave enough. 'Tis not o' they, I'm thinking.'
Tom Carne shifted his position, and took up an even firmer one. The gentle breeze just stirred his whiskers.
"'Now looky here, Demelza. I've walked all this way to see ye, and I've come to ask ye to come home. I've come to see Captain Poldark to explain why.'
As he spoke, she had a feeling as if something were freezing inside her. The new-found daughterly affection would be the first thing to go if all this had to be thrashed out again. Surely it wouldn't have to be. But this was a new and more reasonable father than she had known before. He was not blustering or shouting, or even ordinarily drunk. She shifted to leeward of him, to see if she could catch any smell of spirits. He would be more dangerous if one could not so easily put him in the wrong.
"'Captain Poldark's into Truro. But I've told you afore. I want to stay here. And what about... How is she? The wid... Your...
"'Well, fine. 'Tis she in part do feel you be betterer wi' we than here in this house exposed to all the temptations of the world, the flesh, and the devil. You're but 16 yet.
17?
No matter. You're too young to be without guidance.'
Carne thrust out his bottom lip.
"'Do we ever go to church or meeting house?'
"'Not so often.'
"'Maybe if you comed back to us, you'd be saved. Baptized in the Holy Ghost.'
Demelza's eyes widened.
"'What's to do? What's the change in ye, father?'
Tom Carne met his daughter's eyes defiantly.
"'When you left me, I was in darkness and the shadow of death. I was the servant of the devil, and was iniquitous and a drunkard. Last year I was convinced of sin under Mr. Dimmock. Now I am a new man altogether.'
"'Oh,'
said Demelza. So the widow Chegwidden had been successful after all. She had underrated the widow Chegwidden. But perhaps, indeed, it was more than the widow. It would need something awful to have changed the man she knew.
"'The Lord,' said Tom Carne, "'hath brought me out of a horrible pit of mire and clay, and set my feet upon a rock, and hath put a new song in my mouth. There is no more drinkings and living in sin, daughter. We to live a good life, and we be willing to welcome ye back. 'Tis your natural place in the world.'
Demelza stared a moment at her father's flushed face, then looked down bleakly at her shoes. Tom Carne waited.
"'Well, maid?'
"'It's mortal kind of you, father. I'm that glad there's been a change, but I've been here so long now that this is my home. It would seem like leaving home to come back with you. I learned all about farming here and everything. I'm part of the house. They'd not be able to get along without me. They need me, not you. One day I'll walk over and see ye, you and the boys and all. But you don't need me. You've got she to look after you. There's naught I can do except eat your food.'
"'Oh, yes, there is.'
Carne stared over the horizon.
"'The Lord has blessed our union. Nelly is 6 months forward, and will be delivered in August month. 'Tis your proper place, and your bounden duty to come home and look after us.'
Demelza began to feel that she was caught in a trap, which was only just beginning to show its teeth. There was silence. A curlew had come down in the field, and was taking its little run forward, crested head down, and uttering its sad
peewit
sound. She looked across at Prudy, who had gathered up her tools and was ambling untidily towards the house. She stared at the field of turnips, half thinned out, the other half to do. Her eyes went across the sand and the sand hills to the cliff where two huts were being built, and men moved like ants on the summer skyline. Wheel leisure. She couldn't leave this. Not for anything. She had come to look upon it all, quick and dead, all things alike, as owned by it and owning. She was fiercely attached to it. And, of course, to Ross. If this were anything for him she was being asked to do, it would be different. But instead she was expected to desert him. Not until she came here had she lived at all, though she did not consciously reason so. All the early part of her life was like a dark prenatal nightmare, thought and imagined and feared rather than suffered.
"Where's Captain Poldark?"
Tom Carn said, his voice having hardened again at her silence.
"I come to see him. I got to explain, and then he'll understand. There'll be no call for wrestling this time."
That was true. Ross would not stop her going. He might even expect it of her.
"He's from home," she said bluntly. "He'll not be back till dark."
Khan moved round to meet her gaze, as in the old days he had sidled round to grip an opponent.
"You can't do nothing about him. You've got to come."
She looked at him. She saw for the first time how coarse and common he really was. His cheeks sagged, and his nose was crossed with tiny red veins. But then all the gentlemen were not like the one she served.
"You can't expect me to say yes, just like that, and come away after all these years. I got to see Captain Ross. He engaged me by the year. I'll see what he says and leave you know."
That was it. Get him off the farm before Ross came back. Get him away and allow herself time to think. Tom Carn was eyeing his daughter in return, keenly, with a tinge of suspicion. Only now did he take in the full change in her. The way she had advanced, matured, grown to a woman's shape. He was not a man to mince matters.
"Is there any sin twixt you and Poldark?"
he demanded, in a low, sharp voice, in the old voice of Tom Carn.
"Sin?"
said Demelza.
"Aye, don't look so innocent."
Her mouth tightened. The instinct of an outgrown fear saved him from a reply he would not quite have expected from a daughter's lips, even though they were words she had learned from him.
"There's naught twixt us except what should be between master and servant. But you did ought to know, I'm hired by the year. I can't walk out without so much as a by your leave."
"There's talk about you," he said. "Talk that comes so far as a legging. Whether 'tis all lies or no, 'tadn't right for a young girl to be mixed up in such talk."
"It's nothing to do with me what folks say."
"That's as may be. But I don't want for a daughter of mine to be mingled up in such talk. When will he be home?"
"Not till nightfall, I say. He's gone to Truro."
"Well, 'tis a long way for me to walk here again. Tell him what I've told you, and then come over to Illugan. If you're not back by the end of the week, I'll come over again. If 'tis Captain Poldark putting obstacles, I'll talk and over with him."
Tom Carn hitched up his trousers and fingered the buckle of his belt. Demelza turned and walked slowly towards the house, and he followed.
"After all," he said on a more palliative note, "I'm not asking more than any daughter would do."
"No,"
she said. Buckle end of a strap when it suited him. Sores on her back. Ribs you could count. Dirt and crawlers. Not more than any daughter would do. As they reached the house, Judd Painter came out with a bucket of water. He raised his bald eyebrows at the sight of the other man. Tom Carn said,
"Where's your master?"
Judd stopped and set down his bucket and eyed Carn and spat.
"Over at the Truro."
"What time will he be home?"
Demelza held her breath. Judd shook his head.
Tonight, maybe. Or tomorrow.
Khan grunted and walked on. At the front of the house, he sat on the seat and took off his boot. Complaining of his corns, he began to press the boot into a more comfortable shape. Demelza could have screamed at him. Judd had told the truth as far as he knew it, but Ross had told her he expected to be back for supper at 6. It was now after 5. Tom Khan began to tell her about her brothers. The 5 eldest were all at work in the mines, or had been until 2 were put off when Wheel Virgin closed. The youngest, Drake, was starting as forge boy at a wheelwright's next week. John and Bobby were both saved and had joined the society, and even Drake nearly always went to the meetings, although he was too young to be admitted. Only Samuel was erring. His conviction had worn away, and the Lord had not seen fit to send him mercy. It was to be hoped that when she, Demelza, came back among them, she would soon lay hold of the blessing. At another time, she would have found quiet fun in his new talk, which for all its glibness fitted him as ill as a Sunday suit. She took in the news of her brothers, of whom she was as fond as they had allowed her to be. But above all was the need to see him gone. She could have kicked him to move his great slow body, fallen on him with her nails and drawn red scratches across his coarse, complacent face. Even when he left, she didn't know what was to be done. But at least she would have time to think. She would have time. But if he stayed here talking all day until Ross came home, then Ross would hear of it tonight, and that would be the end. Ross would invite her father to sleep here, and bundle them off in the morning. She stood quivering and watched him while he bent to pull on his boot, angrily offered to buckle it, jerked upright, and stood again silently watching him while he picked up his stick and made ready to go. She walked with him, 2 paces ahead of him, to the bridge, and then he stopped again.
"You've not much to say," he observed, eyeing her again. "'Tadn't like he to be so silent. Have you still enmity and uncharitableness in your heart?"
"No, father," she said quickly. "No, father, no."
He swallowed and sniffed again. Perhaps he too felt a strangeness in talking this flowery language to the child he had been wont to order and bully around. In the old days a grunt and a curse had been enough. He said slowly and with an effort,
"I forgive ye fully, and altogether for leaving me when you did. And I ask forgiveness, God's forgiveness, for any wrong I did ye with the strap in my drink. There'll be no more of that, daughter. We'll welcome you among us, like the lost sheep back to the fold. Nelly, too. Nelly'll be a mother to ye. What you've lacked this pretty many year. She's been a mother to my flock, and now God's given her her own."
He turned and stumped off across the bridge. Standing on one leg, and then the other, she watched him go up slowly into the young green of the valley, and prayed urgently and angrily. Was it to the same God? That he should not meet Ross on the way.
"They calves want feeding," said Prudy. "And my poor feet is trying me something bitter. Sometimes I'd like to saw off me toes one by one. Saw 'em off I would, with that old garden saw."
"Here," said Demelza.
"What's that?"
"The carving knife. Chop 'em off, and then you'll be settled. Where's the meal porridge?"
"Well, to jest," said Prudy, wiping her nose on her hand. "Ignorance always jests. You wouldn't jest when the knife were grating on the bone. And I'd do it if 'twere not for considering what Judd would do without un. In bed, he says, my feet are as good as a warming pan. Nay, betterer, for they don't cool down as the night goes on."
If she went, Demelza thought, there was no need to go so soon. August, he had said. Tomorrow was the last day of May. She need not stay more than a month. Then she could come back here to her old duties. She shook her head. Things would not turn out like that. Once home, she stayed home. And whether the ruling force was the leather strap or religious zeal, she had a feeling that her job would be the same. She tried to remember what the widow Chegwidden had looked like behind the counter of her little shop. Dark and small and fat, with fluffy hair under a lace cap. Like one of those little black hens with red combs that would never lay their eggs in the box, but always hid them away, and then before you knew where you were, they were sitting on a dozen and had gone broody. She had made Tom Kahn a good wife. Would she make a good stepmother? Plenty worse, maybe. Demelza didn't want a stepmother, nor a father, nor even a spawn of brothers back. She was not afraid of work, but there she would be working in a home where no kindness had ever been shown her. Here, for all her ties, she was free, and she worked with people she had grown to like, and for a man she adored. Her way of seeing things had changed. There were happinesses in her life she had not understood until they were on her. Her soul had blossomed under them. The abilities to reason and think and talk were new to her, or they had grown in a way that amounted to newness, from the gropings of a little animal concerned only for its food and safety and a few first needs. All that would be stopped. All these new lights would go out. Snuffers would be put on the candles, and she would see no more. Not heeding Prudy, she slopped the meal porridge into a bucket and went out with it for the six calves. They greeted her noisily, pushing at her legs with their soft, damp noses. She stood there and watched them eat. Her father, by asking if there was any sin between herself and Ross, meant, of course, exactly the same as those women at Grambler and Saul who sometimes would turn and stare after her with greedy, curious eyes. They were all thinking that Ross... Red-faced, she gave a little half-scornful titter in the shadows. People were always thinking things. It was a pity they couldn't think up something more likely. Did they think that if she... that if Ross... would she then be living and breathing as an ordinary servant? No. She would be so filled with pride that everyone would know the truth without having to whisper and peer and pry. Ross Poldark, lying with the child he had befriended, and swilled under the pump and scolded and taught and joked with over the pilchards in Saul. He was a man, and maybe he wanted his pleasures like any other man. And maybe he took them on his visits to town. But she would be the last person he would turn to. She, whom he knew so well, who had no strangeness, no pretty dresses, no paint and powder, no shy secrets to hide from him. Fools people were with their double-damned, soft, silly imaginings. The six calves were fussing round her, rubbing their heads against her body, sucking at her arms and frock with their wet, mealy mouths. She pushed them away, and they came back again. They were like thoughts, other people's and her own, pressing upon her, worrying her all at one time, sly and impossible and suggestive, importunate and friendly and hopeful. What a fool her father was! With the sudden adultness of growing wisdom, she saw that for the first time. If there was anything between herself and Ross like he suggested, would she even for an instant have listened to him asking her to go back? She would have said, "Back? I'm not coming back. This is where I belong." Perhaps it was. Perhaps Ross would refuse to let her go. But there was no proper feeling for her on his part, not beyond a kindly interest. He would as soon become used to her not being in the parlour as he had to her being there. That was not enough. Not near enough. One of the calves trampled on the bucket and sent it rolling to the back of the stall. She went after it, picked it up, and in the darkness of the shed,
in the corner right away from the light, she came up against the most terrible thought of her life. It startled her so much that she dropped the bucket again. The bucket clattered and rolled and was still. For several moments, she stood there holding to the partition, her mind cold and frightened. Madness. He would think her drunk and turn her out of the house, as he had threatened her after that fight with Judd. But then she must go. By any reckoning, she must go. There would be no loss. But she would have to take his contempt with her. A big price to pay. Even if she succeeded, she might still earn his contempt. But she would not go. She picked up the bucket again and gripped it with whitening knuckles. The calves came again, pushing at her frock and hands. Her mood wilted. It was not the right or the wrong that troubled her. It was the fear of his contempt. The idea was bad. Put it away, lose it, bury it. She pushed the calves impatiently aside, let herself out, and walked across the cobbles to the kitchen. Prudy was still there, rubbing her flat, bunioned feet on a dirty towel. The kitchen smelt of feet. She was still grumbling. Might never have noticed that Demelza had been away.
"One of these days I shall go off like a snip of the finger. Then folk will be sorry for driving of me. Then folk will be sorry. But what good will that do, man? What good do it do to shed bitter tears over a cold corpse? 'Tis a little more kindness I want now while the breathing's still in me."
She glanced up.
"Now don't tell me you've caught a fever. Don't tell me that."
"There's nothing wrong with me."
"There must be. You're sweating awful."
"It's hot," said Demelza.
"And what are we doing bringing that bucket sloppering in here?"
"Oh," she said, "I forgot. I'll leave it outside."
Chapter 6. He was not back. She could not make up her mind whether to wish for his coming. The clock showed 8. Very soon both Judd and Prudy would be in bed and asleep. It would be right for her to stay up and see to his supper. But if he did not come soon, he would be staying in Truro overnight. Zaki and Ginny were back. Jack Cobbledick had seen them and the news was about. Everyone was sorry for Jim, and feeling ran high against Nick Vigus. Everyone was sorry for Ginny and the two children. No man was the same when he came out of prison. Demelza looked at the frock and bit her lip and looked at it again. Then she hastily threw bed linen over it, as she heard Prudy flip-flopping laboriously up the stairs.
"I'm going to bed, dear,"
said Prudy, a bottle of gin in her hand.
"If I don't, I shall come over faint. Many's the time when I was a girl I used to swoon off without a breath of warning. If me mother knowed what I've to bear now, she'd stand up in her grave. She'd walk. Many's the time I've expected her to walk. You can see for his supper, eh?"
"I'll see for it."
"Not that he's like to be home tonight. I said so much to Judd. But the old mule says no. He'll wait 25 minutes more. So wait he will."
"Good night," said Demelza.
"Good night? It'll be a shock if I get so much as a wink."
Demelza watched her through to her room, then turned back the linen to stare again at the frock. After some moments, she covered it and went downstairs. In the kitchen, there was a savoury smell of pie. Judd was sitting before the fire whittling a piece of hard driftwood into a new poker for raking out the burnt furs from the clay oven. As he whittled, he quietly muttered his song.
"There was an old couple and they was poor. Tweedle, tweedle, go twee."
"It's been a handsome day, Judd," she said.
He looked at her suspiciously.
"Too hot. All wrong for the time of year. There'll be rain soon. Swallows is flying low.
You shouldn't sit so near the oven,